Eggs and omelets.
These are the ushers of Marcius. Before him he carries noise, and behind him he leaves tears. Death, that dark spirit, in snow the arm doth lie, which being advanced, declines. And then men die.
Coriolanus, Act 2, Scene 1. Back in the task force room, Lainey shook her head in wonder and concern.
Methodical, organized, efficient. That whole meeting lasted what, 10 minutes? Do you know any of our own people who can conduct a briefing and get as much done in that time?
We are getting an idea of what we're up against, said McCafferty. I thought that was the point of the whole operation.
It is, said Martinez. And the answers we're getting are shaping up pretty scary.
Kiki found Lainey Martinez and McCafferty waiting for her at her trailer when she got in at about 2:30 in the morning. Lainey simply held out her hand and Kiki handed over the wireless phone the NVA had given her. McCafferty pulled an electronic meter of some kind out of his briefcase and ran it over the phone.
That looks like something out of Star Trek, commented Kiki.
I don't want to risk taking this cheap thing apart and maybe breaking it, said McCafferty. First thing we need to do is see if this model came with a GPI either installed already or if the Goots installed one to keep track of you.
Nope, no satellite signal.
Looks like your new race's buddies actually trust you, Ms. McGee.
Unlike you, thought Kiki.
Then the more fool's they, said Lainey. Punch up those numbers, Andy.
He did so.
They're masked. Hang on.
He diddled with the meter and ran the rod over it again. She pulled out her notebook.
Can you read the numbers?
Yes, here they are.
He called out three telephone numbers that Lainey jotted down.
Damn, I recognize the series. They're all throwaways like this. Three different models.
Not unexpected. Can they be monitored?
With what we've got, maybe, said McCafferty. Portland PB can access local cell sites, of course, but there's so much traffic that in order to pick these three phones out of a city this size every time they activate, it will require a fairly complex program. I can set that up, and we can do it automatically and have the data fed into our computer system whenever they use these phones, but that would mean outside access for our system, which you said you don't want. Or I can just have the data recorded on CD, and that will help us track them, but we won't have any real-time tracking capability, and by the time we get the info, it might be hours old. The other alternative would be to have full-time manual monitoring, which would mean more people. Three shifts of them for 24/7 coverage.
Damn it, muttered Martinez. There's too many cooks in this soup already.
Should I even bother to suggest bringing in the FBI and using their much more advanced satellite monitoring systems, which can provide real-time coverage on any wireless phone anywhere in the world? Asked McCafferty.
You should not, said Lainey sharply.
Okay, so we stay down market, replied McCafferty with a shrug.
I'll have to think about this, said Lainey. We need to get something set up by the time they call to give Kristen her new car. When you get the vehicle, Kristen, we will tell you where to bring it so we can fully examine it, track the paperwork, and of course, get it fully wired for sound and video. Don't let the thought of screwing with us on that even cross your mind.
I got one question, said Kiki. These guys are asking me now to go out and participate with them in committing crimes. I thought you people were supposed to be into preventing that sort of thing.
Don't be a smartass, snapped Lainey.
No, I mean it. Suppose I'm driving them around one day or night, and I see they're about to kill somebody. What the hell am I supposed to do?
Demanded Kiki, heatedly.
We can't make an omelet without breaking some eggs, replied Lainey.
She simply hoped Chief Linda Hirsch would agree with that assessment.
It's a matter of prioritizing,
said Linda Hirsch later that afternoon, after Lainey and Jarvis had played the recording of the Burger Barn meeting for her and explained the increased stakes in Operation Searchlight.
I agree with your views on the matter, Sergeant Martinez. There is precedent. Undercover operatives have always been required to participate in a certain amount of crime in order to maintain their cover and credibility with the criminals they were infiltrating. However, Most departments have always drawn the line at homicide. Most state and local departments, anyway. Federal is a different matter.
The question here, Chief, is do we prevent one homicide and most likely lose the opportunity to prevent hundreds and maybe even thousands of homicides down the line?
Asked Laney.
So far as I'm aware, we have achieved the only successful penetration of the NVA by any law enforcement agency in the country. I don't need to spell out the implications for you, but surely we have to understand that given the terrorist nature of the organization we are targeting, sooner or later they're going to commit acts of terrorism with our operative present. It's inevitable. It's what they do. A drug undercover has to be present when drugs are sold and consumed, sometimes use drugs, and sometimes use drugs themselves. A hit group undercover has to be present and participate when hateful speech is uttered, and do so convincingly themselves.
How long do you figure before this woman is called upon to participate in an actual murder?
Asked Hirsch.
Judging from what Jackson said last night, it could be any time. And the way they got it set up, we won't have much advance warning,
Laney told her.
So what do? We can track her through the GPI we have on her, and maybe move in fast enough to wherever the scene is to stop the homicide and take out the NVA hit team. But that would be all. Right now what we have, it won't stop there. We don't know where Wingo or Jackson or Lockhart go to Earth, or where any of these other people we've overheard and monitored are. That may change. If we can just keep these girl under long enough to get a more complete read on them, but right now we couldn't even pick any of them up.
Wingo?
Asked Chief Hirsch. Jarvis spoke up.
James Renard Wingo, age 30, born in Thubadoo, Louisiana. We identified him as the man called Thumper and also Bob. His reference to Angola tipped us off. Plus, we found his prints in the house in Gresham. He did a 4-year stretch for committing an act motivated by racial and ethnic or homophobic hatred.
Jamal could speak correct legalese English when required to do so in court, or in the presence of his superiors, or white women he wanted to impress in bars.
What act?
Asked Hirsch.
He assaulted a gay man who made sexual advances to him at a bar in Baton Rouge, said Martinez. His domestic partner, a young woman, turned him in and claimed the $20,000 stay reward for hate crime information from the Louisiana Human Rights Commission.
I bet he really enjoyed showering with all the fellas in Angola prison.
Laughed Hirsch in coarse merriment.
Actually, he became a member of the Aryan Brotherhood prison gang, and he is believed to have committed his first murder in Angola, the stabbing of a black inmate, said Jarvis. He skated on that one because the prison authorities couldn't get any witnesses to testify against him.
Ugh, another one of the NVA's charming revolutionary heroes,
growled Hirsch.
Sergeant, there was a whole gang of that kind of man operating in our city, and they're killing people every day. We have to roll up their whole organization, and it looks like there's not going to be a pretty way to do it. We must prioritize. The first thing you have to clearly understand is that I know nothing about any impending homicides.
Of course not, ma'am,
said Martinez neutrally.
I mean that, Sergeant. Neither of you is to tell me anything about any such impending event now or ever. As important as this operation is, I'm not letting you get Mike took us in a sling over it. You guys will be reaping a good many of the rewards, so you get the privilege of taking the risk. This is political dynamite. I don't have to tell you what will happen if it should get out that we are turning a blind eye to NVA killings and bombings to protect an informant. The public won't understand. Our control of the news media is still by no means as complete as we would wish. And there's always the chance of a leak or some reporter who cares more about a Pulitzer than about duty to his or her country. I will rely on your ingenuity and your no doubt acute political sense to prevent any violent acts against the more socially significant and influential members of the community.
Oh, you mean it's okay for those racist motherfuckers to gun down a few brothers on the street, but if they go after any rich white folk, we got to stop them,
demanded Jarvis heatedly.
That's exactly what I mean, Sergeant,
said Hirsch calmly.
Don't tell me you've gotten as far as you have, and yet you don't know how America works, Jarvis. Under our wonderful liberal democratic system, all animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others.
Oddly enough, the NVA seems to have a penchant for quoting George Orwell as well, ma'am,
said Laney, bemused.
George who?
Asked Jarvis in confusion.
I believe what the chief is trying to say, Jamal, is that the NVA sees America as based on race, when in fact, it is and always has been based on class and wealth, said Laney.
And that means exactly what?
Asked Jarvis suspiciously.
It's actually good news. I mean, anyone can buy their way in, but for us, it means we let Kiki and her friends kill a few brothers and a few muchachos, but not any rich white people, explained Laney.
Before Jarvis could protest, she went on.
But Chief, I think it has to be a bit more nuanced than that. Where exactly do we draw the line? What if we overhear imminent assault and murder directed against a gay person, or an interracial couple, or a Jewish person?
If they're about to harm a Jew, you drop the hammer and you stop it,
said Hirsch immediately and without hesitation.
No matter what the cost, the same goes for any gay man or woman. Beyond that, all I can tell you is use your discretion.
Neither of the detectives needed reminding that Hirsch was both Jewish and lesbian, that they were black and Hispanic respectively, and that their boss's personal minorities were to be given police protection while their own were not. Laney glanced at Jarvis.
I think I understand, ma'am, said Laney. After all, one can't make an omelet without breaking eggs, she repeated.
This better be one hell of a motherfucking tasty omelet, groused Jarvis.
One final thing, said Hirsch. I want to repeat what I told you when this whole operation started. I want Jesse Lockhart, dead or sitting in a cell where I can go to work with him on my Dershowitz needles on his goyish ass. The very minute you get a whiff of him, you drop every other line of inquiry and you concentrate on getting Lockhart. This isn't just personal with me anymore. I don't have to tell you I'm under a lot of pressure, not just from City Hall and the mayor's office, but from the Elliot Weinstein at the FBI and all the other feds we got crawling up our ass. They don't like this constant racial violence in Portland that we don't seem to be able to do anything about. I'm going to need some kind of results, and the way it looks now, it will have to be sooner rather than later.
A few days later, Kiki McGee found herself the proud owner of a dark blue, fairly late model Toyota Camry. She was awakened one morning by her NVA cell phone. She had never heard it ring before, and at first she opened her regular cell, which she kept beside her bed as well, before she realized the chime was from the cheapie Jackson had given her. She got that open and said,
"Yes?"
She recognized the voice on the other end as Thumper's.
"This is your favorite sugar daddy. Happy birthday, darling," he told her. "Look outside. The keys are under your doormat. The title and registration are in the glove box. The emissions inspection sticker is new, and all street legal and righteous."
Then he hung up. Kiki went outside and saw the Camry parked in front of her trailer. The keys were where Wingo had said they would be. It turned out they'd even given her a full tank of gas. She couldn't resist putting on some clothes and taking the Toyota out for a test drive. And she wildly tried to think of some way that she could get away with not telling Martinez and Jarvis about the car so they wouldn't wire it. Then she remembered the strange woman's blank face, like a wax mask, as she had inserted the acid-filled needle, and any thought of resistance collapsed. She duly called in to her handlers, and at their direction, brought the Camry to a garage attached to a Portland police station where McCafferty carefully installed fiber-optic microphones, cameras, and a separate global positioning indicator. Kiki had explained her work schedule to Wingo on the drive back from the Burger Barn, under which she had Monday and Tuesday nights off, and the next Monday, at about 3 o'clock, she was just coming out of the Safeway when she got a text message. She sighed and called Laney on her regular phone. When she answered, Kiki said,
"I just got texted. They want me at Burger Barn 2. That's the corner of Magnolia Street and 31st Avenue. This looks like it."
"All right, we'll go on alert," said Laney. "You know the drill. Do what you're told and do like a good little terrorist."
"Including killing somebody, maybe?" asked Kiki. "You never did give me a straight answer about that."
"Do whatever you have to do to maintain the integrity of this operation, and let us worry about when to intervene,"
said Laney authoritatively.
"In other words, you don't give a damn about anybody else but yourselves."
"Don't worry, I got that a long time ago."
"One more thing, if this goes off okay, I want to see Ellie and my mom. You want to treat me like a naughty child? Okay, you spanked me and you sent me to my room without supper, but I've been a good little girl and I want to come out of my room now."
"Let's see how this plays out and then I'll think about it," said Laney. "Now go play with your dirty little friends."
Laney hung up. Kiki put her groceries in the trunk and drove to the meeting point. It wasn't rush hour yet, so the traffic wasn't too bad. She found a spot on Magnolia Street and parked, then walked to the corner. A powder blue Nissan pulled up beside her. She looked over and saw Thumper, Bob, was driving. "Hop in," he said, opening the driver's side door and sliding over to let Kiki take the wheel. Sitting in the back seat was a third person, a middle-aged man, wearing a cardigan sweater, whom Kiki had never seen before.
"Hang a right on 31st, directed Wingo. "Watch your speed and make all your signals. Keep your eye out for cops and don't do anything to attract attention. The plate on this car should run clean, but we're packing and you don't want to get pulled over. You know the Mighty Mark down the road?"
"Yeah," said Kiki.
"Pull into the parking lot and park as close as you can get to the C1 column. We're meeting the second car there."
"Second car?" she asked.
"We always take two cars on a tickle, sometimes more," explained Wingo. "Tonight'll be one lead car with the assault team in it, and one backup to scout and run interference if necessary. This is the backup car. The action itself will be carried out by the guys in the lead car, two of whom are first-timers like yourself, if that encourages you. I'm the team leader for the mission. Normally I'd be in the lead car, but since this is kind of a training run, tonight I'm here more to observe, to see how y'all do."
Kiki pulled into the parking lot of the giant store and was able to find a space almost exactly under the C1 sign on a lamppost.
"Okay, back park in," directed Wingo. "Anytime you can, always back park. So if you have to beat feet quick, you can see where you're going and floor it."
Kiki complied and turned off the engine.
"The gentleman in the back seat is Mr. Rogers. Mr. Rogers, this is Comrade Jody."
"Hey," said Kiki.
"Hey, Jody," said Mr. Rogers.
"It's a beautiful day in the neighborhood."
"So who are you tonight?"
she asked Wingo. He gave her a boyish grin.
"Hell, everybody in Alpha Company knows my real name by now, and I'm sure the cops must have figured out that I'm around. You can call me Jimmy, but you stick with Jody. You're not a U-boat yet."
"A what?"
"A U-boat, a submarine. You're still floating on the sea of people, as Chairman Mao would have put it. The cops don't know you as a volunteer, or you better hope they don't. So you can operate on the surface. You have a legitimate job, and your above-ground identity is still intact. Later on, you may have to submerge, become a U-boat. But we try to keep as many of our people operating in the open for as long as we can. Saves a lot of hassle with false ID and covert movement, so forth and so on."
A mellow beige Crown Vic passed behind them, and the driver deftly backed into a space two cars down.
"Be right back."
Wingo got out, went over to the other car, and spoke with the driver through the window.
"I have something for you, Jody," said Mr. Rogers from the back seat. He handed her a pistol. "You know how to use one of those?"
Yeah, but mostly from watching movies, though,"
said Kiki, hefting the piece.
"I used to carry a 25 when I was working this one job I used to do. Never used it, though, and since I got out of the can, I carry a lock and a sock."
"It's a 9mm Beretta," said Rogers.
"No, don't fuck with the slide. You have one round up the spout. You see the safety?"
"Yeah, there.
That little lever. It's on. That's the best way to carry when you're packing, because you might not have time to jack in a round if things break bad, or you may get a jam. Although that shouldn't happen if you've taken proper care of the weapon. Plus, somebody might hear you lock and load if it's a surreptitious kind of situation. You shouldn't have to use it tonight, but if you do, make sure you click off the safety and then just cock back the hammer and fire. If some guy is coming at you, aim at his belly button, since you're not used to the recoil. The gun will throw up and to the right, and you should hit him dead center. Even if he's wearing Kevlar, that round is heavy enough to knock his ass flying. And at close range, do some internal damage. You don't have a holster, so carry it on the seat under your leg, so all you'll have to do is reach down and pull it up."
Wingo got back in the car.
"You give her the piece?"
he asked Rogers.
"Yeah."
"Later on, you'll be given intensive one-on-one training with every weapon we have access to," said Wingo. "For tonight, don't take that out unless I tell you, and try not to shoot yourself. Now start her up and follow that Crown Vic."
She did so and followed the lead car back onto 31st Avenue, turning right.
He'll be turning off for Lake Oswego, Wingo told her.
Am I allowed to ask what we're going to do when we get there?
Said Kiki.
If so, can I ask who and why? Or is this a shut up and obey orders kind of thing? I'm kind of curious.
It's not a hit, said Wingo with a laugh. Like the CO said, we're starting you off light. This is a punishment beating, and it's part of our procedure to make sure that every volunteer on an action knows what we're doing, who we're doing it to, and why. It's important for morale for everyone to understand that we ain't just gangsters mindlessly obeying Don Vito. There is a purpose to everything the Army does. The target is a man named Gregory Booth. White, age 35, married with two children. Church-going type. No bad habits we know of. Not a bad guy, really. He's just doing something we need to put a stop to. Booth is a guidance counselor at a high school, and probably because of his 700 Club and other evangelical affiliations, he's pretty neocon in his outlook. Supports the endless wars in the Middle East because we have to have Armageddon over there to make Jesus come back. Really into the whole red, white, and blue moo. You get the idea. The saddest kind of enemy we got. A white man who is bought into the whole American bill of goods and really believes it. You remember what I said about George Orwell's comment that seeing what's right under one's nose requires a constant effort? Well, Booth either cannot or will not make that effort. His eyes and his ears and his mind should have told him long ago that America is a disease that needs to be eradicated for the good of humanity. But he either cannot or will not allow himself to rethink his position. Anyway, Booth has been running the Teach and Tolerance program up at the high school, and that would have put him on our list by itself. But lately, he's started a kind of informal club or secret society among some of his students of all races, mostly of the evangelical persuasion. He calls it Jesus Loves the Little Children, if you can believe that.
Oh, yuck. A damn Christian preppy type, said Kiki in disgust. I had a guidance counselor like that in high school, too. He wanted to save me from my life of sin, and then one night he decided he wanted to do some sinning with me himself. Bastard.
Actually, this guy seems to be fairly straight up. We haven't picked up on anything like that, conceded Wingo. But this little club of his has another kind of sinister undertone to it. It involves the kids in his circle listening in on the other students, doing some snooping in lockers and notebooks and bathrooms and so on, and reporting back to Booth on anyone, student or teacher, who says or does anything politically incorrect or that might indicate racial tendencies or even sympathy with the nationalist cause. The party has ears in all the high schools, going back to before the 1022 revolt, and we got wind of it pretty quick. He's not collecting that kind of information for nothing. He's either passed it on to Zog already, or else he's about to do so. This don't sound like an actual law enforcement operation, too amateurish, but we think he's just a self-appointed guardian of public morals like so many Christians are, running a game on a bunch of dumb kids who think it's cool to play Nancy Drew and Hardy Boys for truth, justice, and the American way. Betray a bigot for Jesus, that kind of shit. So tonight, some of the boys are going to have a quiet word of prayer with Mr. Booth using some blunt instruments.
So why not just kill him? I thought General Order Number 7 gave the death penalty for informing,
asked Kiki.
Yeah, not exactly, corrected Wingo. It says field commanders have authority to deal with it at their discretion. True, usually informing means a bullet to the head, especially if it's for money, but sometimes it needs a lighter touch to send the right message. The message we're going to send tonight works on multiple levels. First, it tells Booth and anyone who may be tempted to emulate him that if you fuck with the NVA, we're going to find out about it, and very quickly. Second, it lets whites know that we really don't want to kill our own people unless it's absolutely necessary. And of course we don't. Like the old man said, this will inevitably turn into a civil war between whites, and once all this is over, the survivors of both sides are going to have to live together in the Northwest Republic. We're looking ahead to that time, and we want to create as little bad blood as possible. And finally, there's the religion thing. Killing Christians only encourages them. They thrive on martyrdom, and persecution is largely the secret of the faith's survival for all these centuries.
We don't want to make Booth a dead martyr. We want him to be a visible wreck in a wheelchair eaten through a straw for some months, in clear and evident pain. Everyone will know that we could have killed him if we wanted to. We can only hope that most folks will understand this and draw the proper conclusion. Okay, here's your turn. Kiki followed the Crown Victoria down a broad, tree-lined residential street. The afternoon was overcast, but not raining, and visibility was good. This street'll be our action zone. Drive down it slow, but not too slow. We always do one preliminary pass through a target zone, but only one so as not to attract attention. You have to check the whole area out in one sweep. As you go by, check every parked car on your left, since you're driving. Your partner will always check on the right, in this case Mr. Rogers. Look for anyone sitting in parked cars or any vehicles with tinted windows, which would be a cop car. Also, any parked vans or trucks on the street or in driveways that might contain enemy troops in an ambush. Look for linemen and cable guys up telephone poles, gardeners in yards who don't seem to be gardening, anything that looks out of place or might indicate that something ain't right. Look for anything that might block your escape route. Now glance over to your right. The Redwood Brady Bunch Split Level Ranch Special? That's Boo's house. The SUV in the driveway is his, so he should be in. Wingo checked his watch. Probably within about 5 minutes of starting out on his daily jog. We've been clocking him for some days now. Okay, up here's where we split up. The Crown Vic will go right, you go left. Kiki complied. Okay, right turn here, and go up about 2 blocks. Watch out for kids on bikes and all that crap. Okay, now another right. Down 1 block. Now right again. And now we're back on our street. Both of you keep your eyes peeled. Okay, there's his house again on the left. Go past it. Now pull over and park here, on the right side of the street. Kiki did so. The lead car will be here in a minute. They're checking the parallel streets in the rear of the house. Adjust your mirrors so you can see the front door and the street in front of the house. While Kiki was doing so, Mr. Rogers wordlessly handed Jimmy an Uzi submachine gun over the back seat and several extra magazines. She glanced back and saw Rogers jack a shell into a sawed-off pump shotgun.
I thought you were just going to beat the guy up. Why all the heavy artillery?
Normally a punishment beating is an 8-man, 2-car job, said Wingo. I know that sounds like a lot to beat the crap out of a single guy, but it's a principle of street fighting. A guerrilla force needs to compensate for the enemy's overall superiority in numbers by applying superior force at selected weak points and pressure points. They outgun us here in the city of Portland, but we always try to make sure that whenever we strike at the one small point, that we outgun them. We're a bit short-handed tonight. There are 3 men in the lead car. 2 of them will administer the actual punishment, while the driver will stand by his vehicle armed with an AK-47. Mr. Rogers and I will cover the attack from here with these weapons. The object is to prevent any interference by Good Samaritans, and also to resist, escape, and evade if the cops show up or if this turns out to be an ambush. Anytime we have enough volunteers, an actual assault team or hitman is covered on at least 2 sides against interference and flanking attacks.
Do I get out and cover them as well? Asked Kiki.
Sure, why not?
Wingo reached into the glove box and pulled out 2 lumps of blue wool. This is your mask. Don't pull it on unless I tell you to. If somebody looks out their window or walks by taking their pooch for a dump and sees 3 people sitting in a car with ski masks on, it kind of gives the game away. All right, there's the lead car. The Crown Vic pulled up 100 feet or so behind them and parked on the far side of the street, just past the edge of Booth's lawn. Wingo's phone beeped. He listened briefly.
Sorry, man. Fred just left for work. Want me to take a message?
Okay, fine. You guys have some cool rides, remarked Kiki. By the by, thanks for the Camry.
Don't mention it. When we're doing a tickle in Lake Oswego like this, we need to use vehicles that fit in with the neighborhood. If we were down on 82nd Avenue, we'd be in pickup trucks or panel vans or 15-year-old beater cars. Right. Our boy seems to be a creature of habit, so he should be out the door any moment now. As soon as we see him, we mask.
He always jogs the same route, turning right towards the park. But if he doesn't go that way this time, we may have to run him down, which Mr. Rogers and I'll do. If that happens, you stay in the car. If he sticks to pattern, as he passes the lead car, the two designated volunteers jump out, do the old Lizzie Borden trick, and give him 40 whacks. There's a certain science to a good thumping. You go for the kneecaps, the elbows, the kidneys, the groin, and the mouth. Never the head, unless you intend to kill the target. When he throws up his arms, you hit them hard enough to break them. This normally wouldn't take more than 20 seconds, but like I said, these two Biff boys are first-timers, and I'll be out of the car and covering the street. You get out of the car and cover the sidewalk to your right. Make sure we don't get any nasty surprises from that side. Level your pistol two-handed, like you know what you're doing. If by any chance you see anyone coming toward us who looks like some idiot civilian with a John Wayne complex, fire a shot over his head to get his attention. If he keeps on coming, Roger I'll deal with him. In the rearview mirror, Kiki saw the front door to Greg Booth's house open, and a man in a running suit with iPod headphones in his ears stepped out of the car. "That's him," said Wingo. "Masks on." Kiki pulled the mask out of her face and adjusted the eye slits. "Out of the car." Kiki opened the door to the Nissan and pointed her weapon to the right, but she couldn't resist turning to watch what was going on behind her. The doors of the Crown Vic were open, and the two masked attackers were on the man in the jogging suit, one swinging a baseball bat and the other an axe handle in a high arc, while the driver stood with his back to them, his Kalashnikov leveled down the empty street. Kiki could hear the soft thwack of blow after blow as she heard Gregory Booth screaming in a high-pitched squeal like a pig being slaughtered. Unbidden, the memory of the little room in the Justice Center arose in her. The needles and the electrodes, the abduction of her daughter, her own humiliation and rage and suffering at the hands of men like Gregory Booth. Any twinge of pity she might have felt was drowned in rage and hate and exultation at the pain of the man being beaten. This American loved and supported the evil people in the evil society that had dragged her brother and her lover to be butchered in Iraq. That had turned her into a whore. That had sent her to prison. That had stolen her baby. He and his kind had never shown her or her loved ones the slightest bit of mercy, and he deserved none himself. "Do unto others as they have done unto you," she thought bitterly. The three masked men got back in the Crown Victoria, and the engine started. They left a twitching, moaning pile of dirty laundry lying on the sidewalk, soaking the concrete red. "Back in the car," ordered Wingo. "Start her up and take her out onto the street, slow. Keep your mask on till we get a few blocks behind us. Okay, now turn right." Behind her, the Crown Victoria turned left. "They'll go a separate route. Now head for I-5 North and get back on into town. Normally, after every mission, there's a debriefing and critique at a safe house or other rendezvous point, but this one seems to have gone perfectly, and I really don't see much need." Wingo opened his phone, dialed, and spoke. "How's it going?" "Yeah. Same here." "Good job, guys." He closed his phone. "Same for you, too. Well, Comrade Jody, looks like you done your first tickle. How you feel?" "Fine," chirped Kiki. And she did.